This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Usually, when we think of black literature, authors such as James Baldwin or Zora Neale Hurston come to mind, and we think of their depictions of black life. But these novelists and many other black writers have also written books with white protagonists. Why is that unexpected? Is there a mandate that black writers need to write about black characters? And what can we learn about white life from looking at these novels? My guest is John Charles. He's an assistant professor of English and Africana Studies at North Carolina State University, and he's written a book called Abandoning the Black Hero. John Charles, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, first of all, tell us, what is a white life novel?
Well, in the most simple terms, a novel by an African-American with a white protagonist.
And there you stumbled on this idea first by reading the work and reading about Frank Yerby, is that right?
No. What happened was I was well into graduate school, and I was looking around for my dissertation project, and I'd been studying African-American lit for some time and came across, and I was reading a literary reference work and just happened across a very short passing reference to these works by figures like Richard Wright, Zora Neale Hurston, James Baldwin, Anne Petrie, Chester Himes, authors whom I was familiar with, but not with these white novels. And possibly what was even more surprising was that in this passing reference, I learned about two writers whom I didn't know about. One was a writer named Willard Motley from Chicago, who wrote a book called Knock on Any Door in 1947. It was a hugely popular best-selling novel. It was made into a film starring Humphrey Bogart. So it had it was extremely popular. And I also came to learn about Frank Yerby, whose name I think I'd heard in passing, but I didn't know anything about him. And I came to discover quite quickly that he was the best-selling black writer of all time. And so now I like to refer to Yerby as the unknown best-selling black writer of all time. He published 33 novels. All but three of them have three of those have black protagonists. The rest have, if not white, non-white, non-black protagonists. And he sold at least 55 million copies.
Wow.
So for me, my project really began from a place of genuine ignorance and interest, and just why have I never heard of these works? And, hey, what can I learn from them? I mean, these are major figures. Richard Wright, Hurston, Baldwin, these are defining figures in the tradition. So what they have to say about whiteness would be pretty interesting.
And in a way, Frank Yerby is quite different from Baldwin, Wright, and Hurston. We have to distinguish, some of the motivation behind why they would create a white protagonist. So let us first talk about Frank Yerby and his most popular book. Tell us about that book and why you think he wrote it.
Well, Frank Yerby is a fascinating figure. He's from Savannah, Georgia, and so you could say that he came by his interest in things Southern, honestly, and this is a genre that he was familiar with. But I think it's worth pointing out that before he published The Foxes of Harrow in 1946, he was writing works that were considered protest fiction, and he was considered a promising young disciple in what was then known as the Richard Wright School of Protest. So actually, even this very same year that The Foxes of Harrow came out in 1946, he actually still had short stories, sort of what we would call protest stories, stories that were overtly critiquing the effects of white supremacy on African Americans, were appearing in these left-leaning sort of little magazines at the time. I just wanted to at least qualify your statement that he was that different from Wright, and of course he is. But he began writing what we could call protest fiction. He said he had actually published, tried to send something out, and it got rejected. And then he turned to the Southern historical romance. So he was a figure who, at the time, as you know, Gone with the Wind, 1946, was hugely popular, right? You know, the novel was 36, the movie's 39, it was being shown everywhere. It had become paradoxically, or not so paradoxically, integrated as a kind of national narrative. It has sort of transcended its status as a Southern narrative, and had become a kind of national narrative in ways that we could say are quite problematic, but nevertheless, it had. So Yerby, I think, on the one hand, not surprisingly, wanted to take on this genre and sort of correct it in some ways. And that was what little scholarship that had been written on Yerby when I started my project it tended to focus on that. So people historically had figured, oh, Frank Yerby writes popular romances. And until fairly recent in the Academy, popular fiction, so-called, you know, these so-called subgenres like even sci-fi we'll talk about, were not really given the kind of critical attention that they deserved because they were popular. So people didn't take him seriously because he was writing popular fiction. And the few scholars who had examined Foxes of Hare and Yerby's body of work more generally, they tended to focus on the moments of critique, the moments where he does revise. So his depiction of African Americans are not deeply offensive stereotypes.
We should probably get a little summary of Foxes of Hare to tell us kind of what this book is about.
Very briefly, it's the story of Stephen Fox, who emigrates, an Irish immigrant. He's a rogue. He's a gambler. He comes in and sort of makes his way into New Orleans society. He sort of gambles his way in and then decides to become a gentleman. And so the story is kind of a saga. It covers several decades. It starts it's in New Orleans and starts, I think, not coincidentally, after the Haitian Revolution. And I'll talk about that. That is in the background of the novel. So it covers, like many historical romances, it follows a family, it covers decades. And it's essentially the rise and fall of Stephen Fox, because by the end of the novel, the Civil War has happened.
He's a plantation owner. He becomes
the master. He is the lord of Harrow. And he becomes great, powerfully wealthy. And then by the after the Civil War, he's lost everything. But one of the things that's interesting is, rather than being sort of bitterly resentful the way you have, say, Scarlett is and other works in that tradition, he actually embraces that loss as something necessary for America to realize its own democratic principles. So that was one of the ways he deviated.
Now, and of course, it sells over a million copies the first year, right?
In the first year alone, it continued, and it sold much more than that over time.
So when we get into this question of protest fiction, which he began with, then he writes this romance, which has perhaps an element or two of critique, but mostly it's popular,
right,
and in many ways reinforces these ideas that were set up in Gone with the Wind.
Right.
Now we talk about Richard Wright, Baldwin, and Hurston, for instance. They also wrote books with white protagonists.
Mm-hmm.
And there'd been some thought that, well, what is this? Is this some example of what Langston Hughes would call the urge to whiteness? What's going on? Are they running away from their blackness? And had that been the kind of dominant critique about what these works represented?
Can I first add one more detail about Foxes of Hare before we shift over?
Absolutely.
To
Absolutely.
And that is that one of the things that I talk about in the work is what I thought was really interesting and worth thinking about is how successful he was in reproducing the genre, and not simply as a way to sell more copies. For me, I focus on his more personal investment and in the form. And the form tends to have a strong patriarchal figure. It tends to have very strong, I mean, Gone with the Wind is that it's exceptional in one respect, in that strong female protagonist. But in the tradition generally, you tend to have a very strong male character. And one of the things I explore in my examination is that I believe that the work doesn't simply critique, which it does, but it also expresses, I believe, it's so sympathetic in its portrait of the slave master, and actually also expresses, I think, indirectly, a kind of longing for the unqualified patriarchal authority that is embodied nowhere in American history in the same way that the plantation lord is. So one of the things I talk about is that part of one of the reasons why Yerby may have turned to the genre, it's not simply that he wanted to make money, and of course that was a consideration, but also I believe there was a conscious and or unconscious desire for an unqualified manhood. And you think about it, that's kind of extraordinary, because as an African-American man in the mid-20th century, that's precisely something that's not available to him. So one of the things I look at, and I'll sum up here, is how on the one hand, the book sympathetically portrays the protagonist, I believe expressing a kind of longing for unqualified manhood. But there are also these moments of rage that sort of emerge in the margins of the novel, such as references to the Haitian Revolution as a sort of background experience. The kind of threat of black rage kind of hovers, but it's not directly represented in the book. So what I explore in my chapter is the profound ambivalence of the novel, because on the one hand, the book voices a kind of admiration and a longing for an unqualified manhood, but also a kind of resentment that very same form of manhood, the oppressive effects, the emasculating effects it had on black manhood itself. So one of the things I do in my book is I don't try to sort of find good or bad, right or wrong. This is a this is a book that should be sort of, it's heroic in its representation or it's villainous and it's in its cowardliness. But rather, I explore the kind of complexity of what it means to be an African-American man going back to slavery in order to create discover a kind of freedom. And that produces, a very, in some ways, not surprisingly, deeply ambivalent novel. So my readings often don't kind of resolve like, oh, we overlook this as bad. In fact, it's good. I'm more interested in what we can learn from what it means to be a black man writing about slavery in positive terms.
And did the American public and his readers know that he was African American?
Most did not. Yeah. And then when the book jackets had pictures of him, Yerby was a light skinned man. So it was ambiguous whether he was black or not.
On the State of Things today, John Charles, Assistant Professor of English and Africana Studies at North Carolina State, his book, Abandoning the Black Hero. Just ahead, we'll talk more about the connection between racial identity and literature on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. John Charles is with me, Assistant Professor of English and Africana Studies at North Carolina State, author of Abandoning the Black Hero. And we're talking about the connection between racial identity and literature. And before the break, we talked about this White Life novel that was written by several African, one version or another, written by several African-American authors. Talked about Frank Yerby in his book. Baldwin, Wright, Hurston all write the same thing. And again, we get into this question of whether they're abandoning, they're running away from their color and aspiring to whiteness. And you say, no, that's not what's going on here. It's by creating white and sympathetic protagonists, they've actually, it's another form of protest literature. Tell us about that.
Right. Well, at the time, Richard Wright's Native Son had cast such a huge shadow. There was a great deal of desire on the part of readers and publishers and editors for more works like Native Son. And the authors, including Richard Wright himself, grew resentful that this sort of pathologized depiction of blackness, this image of blackness as sort of unremediated suffering, was what was eliciting so much desire on the part of readers. And so there became a desire to talk about sort of the function of whiteness in the United States without reproducing black suffering along the way, right? So these works, while they, in many cases, Yerby is somewhat unusual with these books because the color line is so visible. But in these other works, the color line is often very marginalized, if not entirely displaced, such as in works by Wright and Baldwin. At least when I say the color line, I mean white and black. There are no identifiably black characters in James Baldwin's Giovanni's Room. There's a reference to a brown character, but he's not identified as black. And one of the things that these authors do is that they, rather than sort of representing themselves as injured others, they speak sympathetically about white suffering in order to reverse the gaze, in order to reverse the lens of suffering. In other words, they're able to produce themselves as subjects of sympathy rather than objects of sympathy, which allows them to sort of create a kind of more expansive moral and critical authority without reinscribing themselves as the suffering black other. And in that process, what they do is they take on the unconscious or norms that tend to structure whiteness and white manhood in particular, in order to make the argument that while we might tend to think of whiteness and white manhood as being this powerfully privileged subject position, the norms that regulate what proper whiteness is, and specifically what proper straight white manhood, actually injure whites themselves. So what they do is they tend to show these white protagonists suffering in some ways, and that their suffering has to do with their conscious or unconscious need to conform to the norms of white manhood. And what they show is that eventually, if these characters are willing to relinquish their possessive investment in their straight white manhood or their whiteness, then they can actually they can gain more freedom themselves.
Well, Samuel Delaney is widely renowned as a black writer, and he is best known, I think, for his science fiction work such as the Triton Trilogy. He creates protagonists of many different races. His newest novel is called Through the Valley of the Nest of Spiders, and it chronicles the lifelong relationship between two men, one black and one white. Early reviews have been glowing, and we chatted about it yesterday on phone.
The main character character, which is to say the one we spend most of our position, most of our time with, is indeed a young white man who, a young white man who starts off days before his 17th birthday. He's easier, I think, for an audience to identify with because, among other things, he's been raised by a black, in large part by a black family. And he yearns to be black. And somebody who wants something is always easier to identify with, and who, you know, and puts out energy to sort of bring it about, is easier to identify with than somebody who is not in that position. And the young black man that he gets involved with and spends the next 70 years of his life with is perfectly happy in his own situation, and sort of looks at Eric and finds this aspect of Eric both interesting. He even finds it attractive, but it's not something that he particularly shares. You know.
Well, in America, is it possible to write a novel and not consider race? Can the protagonist, does the race not matter in a place like the United States of America?
I think that's absurd. No, of course it always matters. It always, even when the, you know, when somebody, as happens has happened very frequently in my life, I will be in a group of writers and I will be the, or a group of young people who are interested in writing, and I will be the only black writer there, and someone will say, well, I never even knew any black people until I was 35 years old, you know, and so if I were writing a book, you know, there wouldn't be any black people in it because I never knew any. Well, the point is, if you lived a life in which you never met any black people are very important in your life, you know, because the very fact that they were kept out of it, you know, given how many black people there are in the country, if you actually grew up and didn't meet any, that means you led a very strange life, given what the makeup of the country is, and that you were in the center of some very interesting forces that kept your life as free of blacks as it did.
Well, let's stay with that for just a moment. Does that character, does that individual you met spark your curiosity to the point that you would want to make him a protagonist in your next novel? Who is this guy? Do you want to get into his head?
Well, in my case, no. In my case, no, because I am a black writer, and I'm more interested in writing about blacks and whites. You know, I might. It's not that I'm not interested in writing about blacks. It's just that I want to write about. I want to either write about black people who have had similar experiences to my own, or I want to write about, you know, people who have had experiences that I've seen, because I've always had white friends, and I want to write about them as well. So the idea of writing about some of these others, no, I'll let them do that. They can write about that, and if they are interested in writing about the forces that kept their lives free of blacks, that should be very interesting. I'm waiting for that novel to be written.
This whole topic, it seems to me, raises even bigger questions about how a writer gets identified or chooses to identify themselves. Mm-hmm. In your case, you've written all kinds of stuff, scholarly articles, literary criticism, and science fiction. Science fiction to critical and popular acclaim. Do you identify yourself with any of those? Do you consider yourself a science fiction writer?
Well, for the last 35 years, most of my stuff, I haven't written very much science fiction, very, 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 very little science fiction in the last 35 years. But I think of myself as certainly as a black writer, and as a black writer, a gay writer, because I'm a, you know, a gay African American, and it's been my life, and so that's those are some of the those are some of the currents of experience that have fed, you know, that have nurtured and fed my life with the experiences that I've had. So they're going to be the things I'm going to be writing about.
Given all of the things you've written about, particularly in the area of science fiction, are some of your readers surprised to find out that you're black and gay?
Not for the last 35 years.
Right.
I think up until about 1960, I started writing when in 1962, and I think for the first 4 or 5 years there were some who were. But I think after the first 4 or 5 years, I don't think anybody was particularly surprised. By 1968, it was well known by anybody who was likely to pick up a Samuel R. Delaney book that both I was both black and gay.
You said you identify with both of those areas, that you are, you identify as a black writer and a gay writer. Do you feel pressure to represent blackness and gayness in your work?
No, it's rather again. I think because I'm black and gay, it's an alert light to the readership. You be on the watch out to see if you can tell the things that have gone into some of these stories and where they came from. I don't feel any pressure to write in a particular way because I'm black or gay, although I'm very much aware that I am.
That's author Samuel Delaney, and we spoke with him yesterday by phone. His latest book is called Through the Valley of the Nest of Spiders. And we spoke to him as part of our larger conversation about minority novelists and their use of white protagonists. John Charles is an assistant of English and Africano Studies at North Carolina State University. He's got a book called Abandoning the Black Hero. Jennifer Ho is also with me. She's an associate professor of English and comparative literature at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Jennifer, welcome. Good to have you here.
Hi, delighted.
So you're Chinese-American, and you specialize in Asian-American literature. Is the white life novel a subgenre of Asian-American literature as well?
No, I wouldn't say that that term appears within Asian-American literary criticism. But I do think that colleagues of mine and I myself have been thinking about how we define Asian-American literature. And in particular, what happened in 2008 was there's this annual Association of Asian-American Studies. And it's sort of the national, international body of Asian-American scholars. That year, the book award for best Asian-American novel was given to James Janco, who is a white American veteran of the Vietnam War. And that sort of, for me, raised the question of if we're giving the book award for Asian-American best novel to a white American veteran of the Vietnam War about a novel set entirely at Vietnam with a Chicano protagonist, what does that mean for how we're defining Asian American literature?
How would you define it?
Well, I would define Asian American literature, or rather how I do for my classes, is novels writing by people who identify as Asian American about Asian American experiences. Having said that, in an article I wrote a few years back, I actually ask somewhat rhetorically, but I think increasingly as I've been thinking about this more seriously, about opening up the canon to non-Asian American identified writers who are writing about Asian American identified themes.
It seems to me it's an interesting question anyway. If you say Asian American, you're not saying the same. It's not the same quality, right, as African-American in terms of shared experience, it seems to me. Does that make a difference?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. I mean, the process of how Asian-Americans came to be Asian-American in the United States is vastly different. I think what African-American and Asian-American share as non-white minorities in the United States is precisely that, being subject to racist state practices, being subject to white supremacy, not having access to white privilege. However, there is not the same kind, the ways in which I think African-Americans can look at a common experience like slavery, right, being descended from slaves or the transatlantic slave trade. Asian-Americans are really coming from a plethora of ethnic national experiences. There's no common language, there's no common food, there's no common immigration experience. And so it's really an ideological and political category.
And isn't it the project of the writer? Well, now we'll just take a look at the craft and the art of literature itself. Isn't that the job of the writer, to get outside of themselves and to put themselves in the mind of someone else? I mean, it raises the question, can a man create a female character? Is that the same question?
You know, I think for me there are two, maybe three questions that are embedded. One is the right of any writer to take on any material that they creatively want to think about. And I think any writer has absolutely the right to creatively think about what they want to write. I mean, we were just listening to the piece about Samuel Delaney and his science fiction writer in his earlier part of his career. I mean, he's never spent time on a planet other than Earth, but he imagines what it's like to spend time on a planet other than Earth. And I think every writer has that right to imaginatively think about that. What gets tricky is what we put on college syllabi, what we sanction for awards. And I think that's when we come up with issues of representation and then this thorny question of authenticity.
Well, John, let me ask you about whether the black authors of white life novels felt a certain aesthetic freedom, or that it gave them an aesthetic freedom, a creative freedom, apart from whatever social justice questions they might want to raise.
Well, again, specifically, that would absolutely be the case, particularly for the mid-20th century. A figure like Samuel Delaney, I think, his sense of freedom and an authorial entitlement is definitely symptomatic of changing racial practices, the status of race and blackness and whiteness in the United States. But at the time, there was no question that the idea of Negro literature was considered for many, a ghettoizing term, and there was no shame about black life or black experience on the part of the authors, but the idea that a Negro was only capable of writing about what it means to be black in a white man's world was profoundly offensive and wrong.
It wasn't Richard Wright who said it is to be regarded fatally as the Negro writer.
Right. Paradoxically, at the height of his career, when he was publishing Black Boy, his autobiography, in 1945, he was literally writing in his journal, his private diary, what other work can I do? I want to do something else. I want to work for the government. A strange choice for Richard Wright. But he was literally fantasizing, what can I do because I'm regarded fatally, so as a Negro writer. And that, in other words, the idea that the status of being a Negro writer as a label was a kind of authorial death, essentially, for him.
Would you forgive me for interrupting,
no problem.
You talk about, and I think central to much of your argument, is this question of authorial privacy. What do you mean by that?
Well, privacy is a notoriously difficult concept to define, but it's easier sometimes to talk about privacy in terms of what it protects, why privacy is so important. And privacy protects freedom. Privacy protects autonomy. And so, for example, white authors had racial privacy insofar as they could function as authors. No one ever said a white writer has to talk about being white in a white man's world, right? They could write about whatever they wanted in general. So an African American, so when I talk about these authors writing sympathetically rather than attacking white supremacy in these white life novels, I see that as a way to acquire some degree of racial privacy insofar as it allowed them to talk about whiteness without reproducing themselves as Negroes, right, as injured, specifically because the idea of blackness was so circumscribed in the mainstream imagination in the mid-20th century that there was a desire to do what authors do, which is think new thoughts. That's what all artists want to do. They want to think new thoughts.
And what this implies, of course, is that it really doesn't matter. We shouldn't have to know anything about the author. And Jennifer, I'll put this question to you. Should it not matter at all what I know about the author? The work has got to stand on its own.
You know, I go back and forth about this because as a reader, sure, I want to be able to just read the literature and enjoy the literature without knowing. But as an Asian American professor and one who believes very firmly in issues of social justice, then it does matter. It matters that I have on my syllabus that I'm supporting contemporary Asian American writers who identify as Asian American and who are writing about the experiences of being Asian American in this country when there aren't a lot of narratives and there aren't a lot of stories about Asian Americans that get circulated at all.
And then the question is whether or not these reinforce stereotypes or break stereotypes when you're writing from that position.
Exactly, which is one of the reasons I'm very careful in my own syllabi to try and choose works that I think, you know, it's not that I want to come up with a kind of PC clean syllabus, but I'm careful to try and pick works that I think really show the range and the breadth and depth of Asian American life and writing.
What about books in popular culture, very popular, Joy Luck Club, that sort of thing, that become very popular and represent to a larger audience Asian American writing? Right?
You know, when John was talking earlier about about Baldwin not being wanting to be labeled with the protest novel label. I was thinking about Amy Tan, and I was thinking about every other writer doesn't want to be labeled as the next Amy Tan, doesn't want to have to fit into some kind of pigeonhole about writing mother-daughter conflict stories and, you know, what it was like in pre-communist China.
Well, I want to thank you both for talking with us today. Jennifer Ho, Associate Professor of English and Comparative Literature at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. John Charles, Assistant Professor of English and Africana Studies at North Carolina State University, author of Abandoning the Black Hero. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you.
You can read, Jennifer's writing at mixedraceamerica.blogspot.com. And John, where can we find out more about your book?
My book comes out of Rutgers University Press.
All right. All that is true. And coming up next, the North Carolina Opera performs Wagner. Stay with us on the State of Things.